We all know Moses as the leader of the Israelites, the one who led them out of Egypt, one of the good guys. But the first story written about his adult life is about his failed leadership and his violent nature. Today's scripture reading from Exodus chapter 2 tells this story of the murderer Moses, who goes on the run from the king of Egypt. Time passed. Moses grew up. One day he went and saw his brothers, saw all that hard labor. Then he saw an Egyptian hit a Hebrew, one of his relatives. He looked this way and that. When he realized there was no one in sight, he killed the Egyptian and buried him in the sand. The next day he went out there again. Two Hebrew men were fighting. He spoke to the man who started it. "Why are you hitting your neighbor?" The man shot back, "Who do you think you are, telling us what to do? Are you going to kill me the way you killed that Egyptian?" Then Moses panicked. Word's gotten out. People know about this. Pharaoh heard about it and tried to kill Moses. But Moses got away to the land of Midian. He sat down by a well. The priest of Midian had 7 daughters. They came and drew water, filling the troughs and watering their father's sheep. When some shepherds came and chased the girls off, Moses came to their rescue and helped them water their sheep. When they got home to their father, he said, "That didn't take long. Why are you back so soon?" "An Egyptian," they said, "rescued us from a bunch of shepherds. Why, he even drew water for us and watered the sheep." He said, "So where is he? Why did you leave him behind? Invite him so he can have something to eat with us." Moses agreed to settle down there with the man, who then gave his daughter Zipporah, meaning bird, for his wife. She had a son, and Moses named him Gershom, meaning sojourner, saying, "I'm a sojourner in a foreign country." The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God.
I want to say good morning to our radio congregation listening in and those following on Facebook Live this morning, too. And just to let you know that Pastor Chris continues his vacation out west. He'll be home this week. If you want to follow his antics on Facebook, head to his Facebook page, you can do that. I think he's having a good time. Well, we continue our summer sermon series on fear and courage this morning. And this morning I want to get us thinking about the fear of failure, but also how life with God, life lived in the hope and the grace of God, can help us move on from this, move on from that fear of failure with courage. I think most of us struggle to some degree with the fear of failure. Some of us do more so than others, but I think because of the nuances of this and the way its tentacles kind of reach out in different ways, I think all of us experience it to some degree. Maybe it comes in the form of a guilt that, you know, because we've messed up so many times. Or in the form of shame, you know, where we just don't feel like we're good enough, like we add up. Maybe we struggle with the fear of failure in relationships, where we are fear of disappointing others or being disappointed. Maybe we've been burned by others to the point where we give up trying. Maybe we fail so many times ourselves, you know, that we blame ourselves hard. We just want to give up. Fear of failure can make you overly cautious, sensitive to criticism. It can turn us into perfectionists as well as procrastinators. I think about this too in terms of the culture of success that we live in every day. And what I mean by that is how the dominant culture tells us, you know, gives us that definition of success, what we should be accomplishing and what we should be achieving. And it's easy in the light of that, I believe, to sometimes feel like you don't measure up. There's many reasons to have a fear of failure. I'm mindful, too, that the fear of failure can be specific to different times and seasons of life. You know, the fears we have as children are different than, as Andrew and Catherine were saying this morning, different than what we fear as adults. But we also know that those childhood fears can sometimes follow us, right? Especially the traumas of our lives follow us into adulthood. One statistic I was reading said that 85% of us suffer from some degree of low self-esteem. Wow, I thought. Not sure if I agreed with that, but, you know, we can be troubled by failure to the point where it can be really hard on ourselves and feel down on ourselves. But, you know, I think it's human to have those kinds of feelings. For some of us, it's just maybe a little more pronounced and amplified. How about you? Can you recall a time when the fear of failure got the best of you when you were trying to accomplish something? Have high expectations of success, perfectionism by yourself or others cause you to give up, not want to try? But you know, friends, while we do fear failure, and what causes it is real, I also believe that the aspiration and the hope to become something more, to accomplish goals, to lean into the greater purpose of life or why we're here, it is also just as real. Well, there's the rub, right? The struggle, but also the calling and the promise. I believe that each of us has that force, though, within us to be fully human, to live a fully alive life, to be confident and joyful. As people of faith, we call that the mark of the divine, don't we? We call that the Spirit of God live and living in us, the grace of God that makes a way for us at every turn. And I think what that means is that becoming fully human is a journey that we're on. But it's also hard work some days. It's also risky business some days. But here's the thing. We're not alone, are we? Most of the world's successful people have had to overcome their own fears of failure and the blunders they made along the way to get where they were going. I like that little story about Thomas Edison, who failed 1,000 times in trying to create the light bulb. Or maybe it was 999 times, and on the 1,000th time he got it right. Probably, right? But I think about this too from the spiritual perspective. Consider the struggles of John Wesley, the founder of the Methodist movement, and what he went through as he was trying to work out his own faith. In 1735, Wesley, full of a missionary zeal, set sail for England for the new colonies. He landed in Georgia, in Savannah. And one of his goals was to teach the Native Americans about Christ and convert them to Christianity. Well, as the story goes, he not only did not convert the Native Americans to Christianity, but he left the colonies feeling defeated. And in one journal entry, he wrote, "It's now almost 2 years and 4 months since I left my native country in order to teach the Georgia Indians the nature of Christianity. But what have I learned myself in the meantime? Why, what I least of all suspected, that I who went to America to convert others was never myself converted to God." You see, for some reason, you read Wesley's story, for some reason, through most of his life, he struggled to feel good enough in God's eyes. He struggled to feel accepted by God. Wesley also struggled as a husband in his failed marriage to his wife Molly, and while he was out winning souls for Christ, his wife was feeling neglected. Their spats were well known, and journals told the story of their on and off again marriage. One story told of Molly dragging John across the floor by his hair. And when Wesley left for a mission trip to Ireland in 1758, Molly reported that her husband's parting words to her were, "I hope I shall see your wicked face no more." Wow. So the man who was able to bring the love of Christ to the everyday person of his generation, especially the poor, the disenfranchised, those who have been pushed away from church, the man who set the British Isles on fire, ablaze, with a new enthusiasm for God, a revival that spread to the colonies, to America, and led to the founding of the Methodist Church in, in 1784 was far from perfect. Which is ironic because, as us preachers know, one of the questions Wesley always asked those he was ordaining to be a pastor, question still asked us today, is, are you going on to perfection? Do you expect to be made perfect in love in this life? And we answer yes. Seems there should be a question in there about expecting to make a lot of mistakes along the way too, though, doesn't it? Yeah. But that's a good question for all of us. You know, even though we do fail at it most days, it's important because, you know, that is that ideal, I think, that we aspire to be more perfect in love every day we live. I'm glad for the height of that bar. And I'm glad that people like Wesley were not perfect. They had their own fears of failure. It humanizes them, doesn't it? And we can relate better. Here's something I want to say about that. It strikes me that in the church too often, we trip up on this perfection thing. And we too often put ourselves on a pedestal or we put others on a pedestal, you know, to be perfect, to expect expectations to be perfect, or at least to act like we are. That it's not okay to be vulnerable. That it's not okay to be fallible. But here's the thing. The obsession with perfection is so unhealthy. And it causes us to deny, to cover up really what needs healing in our lives and what needs healing in the life of our community. What can bring hope even because it's so real. And I think the more real we are, the more vulnerable we are as Christian community about our imperfections, the more helpful we are to each other. You know, the more helpful we are to the world that looks at us and maybe thinks, you know, they're perfect. I don't belong there. What we need, my friends, is examples of people who mess up and fail and fear, but who also, because of their sense of God wooing and calling them, don't give up either. Our fears are always going to seek to undo us. Our failures are going to try to hold us back, but we don't have to give in because there is something more powerful calling us, always calling us on. I think of the story of the character Moses. That was read today. Moses' story picks up where the story of the patriarch Jacob ends. Jacob and his family went to Egypt to escape a great famine. Jacob's son Joseph, after being abandoned, left for dead by his jealous brothers, is sold into slavery. But by a divine grace and in time, he becomes a prince in Egypt, a prince of the Pharaoh. And because of that, by the end of the book of Genesis, the family is safe and secure in Egypt. The book of Exodus that follows that begins with this statement about the Israelites, the descendants of these patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. It says they were fruitful and prolific and that they had grown exceedingly strong in the land of Egypt. So there's the stage right there. But the Pharaoh was afraid of them. Afraid that the Israelites were growing so in numbers and in power, and so with the force of an army, he made them slaves, and he commanded as well that the firstborn males would be drowned in the River Nile. And Moses is born into that chaos. Maybe you remember the story, though. Instead of having her child drowned, she hid him in a basket in the reeds of the Nile, where he was discovered by the Pharaoh's daughter as she was bathing. And just when you think it's going to be over for Moses, the Pharaoh's daughter, love struck with this child, takes Moses as her own. He's allowed to be raised by his mother for a time until he can live with her in the Pharaoh's palace. And that brings us to today's story, where the now 40-year-old Moses, this adoptive son of the Pharaoh, this warrior of the Pharaoh, seems to no longer be able to bear the pain of his people. He's living in comfort and they're suffering in slavery. In anger, he lashes out. He kills an Egyptian who's beating a Hebrew slave, which sends him on the run for his life, running from the Pharaoh who seeks to kill him for the murder. Now, when you hear the first part of the Moses story, You can't help but think that Moses, like Joseph before him, is brought into that Pharaoh's palace. He's placed in that position with some kind of sense of destiny, right? He's going to be a deliverer. But then you hear the rest of today's story, and you wonder if that's ever going to happen, right? As Moses runs for his life, he hides out, eventually settles in, marries, has a family in the land of Midian. And for 40 years, he calls this wilderness sanctuary his home. But Moses finds out what we all know, that you can run from God, but you can't hide. And in the verses that follow, Moses, the herdsman, hears God call his name. As he's feeding his flocks at the base of Mount Horeb, a.k.a. the mountain of God. I've heard the misery of my people in Egypt, and I will send you Moses to Pharaoh to tell him to let my people go. Now, as that part of the story goes, Moses wrestles with God, tries to talk God out of the idea, even says, send somebody else, God. But eventually, Moses is on his way back to Egypt. And at the age of 80, he stands before the Pharaoh and he says, let my people go. Fear of failure had gotten hold of Moses, even though he knew God's people needed a deliverer. But in the end, with God's help, the job gets done. Now, he messes up a lot more along the way, believe me. He complains a lot, and throughout the story, the Israelites, as they journey over these 40 years of wandering around in the wilderness, don't like Moses much. They continually blame him for leading them out into the wilderness to die. He's not a popular man. But at the age of 120, he hands over the reins to Joshua, who leads the Israelites into their new home in Canaan. Moses was willing to do what every courageous person is willing to do, move from failure to failure without losing enthusiasm for where they're called to go. That was the Churchill quote in your bulletin today, to move from failure to failure. I like that, don't you? So again, have you struggled with that fear of moving forward? When have you blown it and you had to pick yourself up and pull yourself together and try again? Yesterday, here in the sanctuary, I led a memorial service for Jim, or Brew Baker, as he was known by family and friends. Brew had lived a good life. Not an easy life, but a good life. In spite of being a best friend and spouse to Sarah, a great father to Jamie, Brew struggled with serious illness in his life. In midlife, he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis and as well with bipolar illness. Sarah said I could tell his story because I think it's an important story, especially for the message today. In time, he was forced to give up his job with community mental health as an occupational therapist. And like a lot of people with mental illness, he struggled to feel whole and safe. But he didn't give up. And one of the things he did is he took to art as a form of therapy for his illness. He created many beautiful, powerful paintings. And we had those on display here yesterday as a part of the memorial service. And one in particular stood out. And I asked Sarah if we could keep this for this morning. And I invite you to come and look at it afterward. But I want to describe it to you. It's called The Box of Silence. And it's a painting that depicts a person standing on a big black box, actually standing on a globe or a world on top of this big black box. And the world seems to be emerging out of this box called the box of silence, the person in the world moving up and away. But on the box are words like these: shame, stigma, fear, feelings that those who have a mental illness struggle with so often. But the painting, as you can see there, shows the person climbing up and away from that box on the ladder toward up into the sky and toward the light, toward the moon. As I learned yesterday, even more so from family and friends here, that was Brew. Even though he felt shame and fear, stigma from mental illness, he kept climbing toward the light. I think all of us here can relate. All of us know the fear of failure. Most of us have made our way through it with faith and family and friends, love and assurance, most of us have been able to pick ourselves up and carry on. But you know, Bruce's story reminds me that some of us have it difficult. For some of us, it's really hard to do that, to overcome those fears. But we also see that it's not impossible. It's not impossible, and it doesn't have to be perfect first for that to happen. All of us possess this indomitable, this unconquerable spirit that enables us to do the difficult deed, to fail miserably and then get up again and try again, to face hardship and harassment head on, to risk disappointing those we love, to take the difficult stand, to bear stigma, shame without letting it hold us down, to be courageous. But how? Well, as Christ followers, we say it in a word, grace. We say it in the word grace. The grace of those who don't give up on us even when others have. I like the story of the promising junior executive who involves his company in a risky venture and it results in a $10 million loss. And the CEO calls the nervous executive into his office and the young person blurts out, I guess you're going to want my resignation. And the CEO replies, you can't be serious. We have just spent $10 million educating you. Yeah. The grace of those who stand by us. The grace of knowing we don't always have to get it perfect. We don't have to do it on our own. I think as well as the grace of humility that helps us, how we see ourselves in others, is not having to be perfect, but as becoming, always becoming, going on to. And of course, the grace of God that never stops believing in us, never stops calling us to work with God and show God's grace to others, the grace of Jesus Christ, the grace of acceptance of us. The grace, I would say, of a two-way ladder as well. Because what we find, and what our story says, is that as we reach for God, we find God already reaching for us. And I think, too, the grace to trust that my life is never void of meaning and purpose, never void of it, that my story within God's story is still being written. The grace of courage that keeps risking failure because it knows that's the way to joy and peace. You know, as I look back on my 59 years of life, I'm amazed at this grace. I am amazed at it and how it has always come along, has always come my way. And I think, friends, if you look good and hard, and maybe you don't have to look too hard, that you'll find that too. You'll be amazed as well, and you'll be grateful as well. So don't be afraid to fail and try again. Don't be afraid to become, keep becoming. There's too much riding on it. There's too much riding on it for you and for those whose lives you will touch. Thanks be to God. Amen.